Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag Save Our Shirt.
And you're very welcome along to tonight's football show. Richie McCormack at the helm. The Irish Independent's Dan McDonald joins me in studio as well. We were going to bring you up to date on Wolves. They're leading 1-0 away in Torino.
Who cares?
The story of the night is up in Belfast. I'm not going to say I've left my magic pixie dust behind in that city where I was for the past 48 hours. But Linfield are leading Carabag.
They're beating Carabag 2-1 with 25 minutes to go in the first leg. So... £4 million at stake for Linfield. I mean, Northern Irish clubs wouldn't have a reputation for being the most stern, formidable European opponents. Like, they've actually lost a place in recent years. Like, they're down in the nether regions of like the bottom four at like 55. Now, Linfield's results this year have won that place back for them, essentially. Yeah. But now to be on the cusp of the group stages. Like when Carabag played on Dock, like, oh, this is a top team.
That's what I was just going to say. The narrative around Carabag was, well, in reality,
different level.
They're a different level. Dundalk knew that if they did get a result over them, it would be something exceptional because they're a different gravy at that level of football. They're used to playing group stages, yada yada yada. Linfield, like, I know there's another 90 minutes to go in, you know, Azerbaijan. Linfield beating them tonight is a huge, huge story.
Yeah, no, I mean, as you say, they've got a job to do to hold out and haven't been over there for the away leg. I mean, if it wasn't an underdog tie, you know, a scenario where Linfield were massive underdogs, you'd say the team 2-1 away, well, they just need to win 1-0 at home to go through.
Yeah.
But just not like, take that out of it for now. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if Carabag scored again tonight, but like, strip it away. What Linfield have done is extremely impressive because Carabag did look like the business. And, you know, over the past week or 10 days, you know, a couple of weeks, when the Irish clubs go out of Europe, the Southern clubs go out of Europe, we always have these big debates of, well, we're miles off. But it's cup football sometimes as well. You sort of forget. And Carabag in the last 10 minutes in Dundalk actually rocked. And Linfield, by the sounds of it, were getting battered for 40 minutes. They were 1-0 down. And then they scored from two corners and they've taken control. And it's all about momentum. I mean, I always love this round. To me, this is like, it's real sort of niche, nerdy territory. But this last round of like the Europa League, like the range of clubs involved, from the range of leagues, from Armenia to Luxembourg to Northern Ireland, to clubs you've heard of. And there's so much at stake for all of them. Their whole year revolves on like 180 minutes. And desperately wanted one of our clubs to be involved in that. All the teams that Dundalk played are playing tonight in that round, including Riga, who they beat. They still got through this new route for champions to get knocked out. They can get into the Europa League by playing other champions. That's like, Linfield lost 6-0 to Rosenborg in their first tie. You're looking at it going, that same old. But then they got a team from the Faroes, a team from Montenegro, and they suddenly play in this game now with a chance to go through.
Yeah, because I kind of figured, like, because my day-to-day is obviously doing bulletins in here. You kind of get to see the progress as the weeks go on of these sides. And Sochesco were on other sides. Obviously, we're talking about the Champions League and the Europa League playoffs, who had fallen down from the Champions League, who, to the best of my knowledge, weren't that bad a side anyway. And Linfield managed to get past them.
They did, although I know someone had done a bit of scouting at Sochesco and didn't think they were that much good at all.
Okay.
But they did manage to...
I'm not saying I'm a genius on this front, Dan. I'm just saying you kind of... The optics, as we mentioned to Breed before, about, you know, football, you kind of figure that Montenegrin champions' previous results weren't necessarily awful.
No.
That Linfield, as you mentioned, usually going out and usually fodder for other sides in the early stages of these qualifiers, suddenly got past them, and here we are.
Like, in clubs in Northern Ireland, you'd hear routinely of their manager and players missing games because they're on holiday. Like, they have a really part-time culture. The interesting thing about Linfield, by the way, this is actually if Linfield get through, it's going to create like a massive problem because of fixtures. And there's a debate that Linfield might have to play on a Sunday for the first time, basically, in their history. You forget that. I mean, you've been up there. Like, we share an island. But
it's a very different place.
It's a very different place, and there's been a religious outcry already north of the border at the prospect of Linfield possibly playing on a Sunday, which would be, we are told, this would be against the traditions and cultures and of what we should know, everything that we should aspire to be in Northern Ireland. Playing association football on a Sunday might cause some kind of problems.
Yeah.
That would destroy the fabric of our society. And if Linfield get through, I mean, this is the shitstorm they're going to have to deal with then eventually. As Linfield said, we wouldn't mind playing on Sundays because we're going to be playing on these Thursdays. like for like 6 weeks, and it's going to be pretty important. I mean, don't fancy playing on Saturday.
I mean, priorities, really, when you think about it. Like, devolved government hasn't sat for, 18 months or more. Mm. Brexit coming down the line may have a hard border imposed, but God damn it, if Linfield play on a Sunday, that is Northern Ireland gone to hell in a...
The game is gone, basket. Completely. I mean, absolutely. The game's gone. This is when we know we're really screwed.
It's absolutely bizarre. We should mention as well, Wolves have a decent result on their hands as things stand. Granted, there's another 40 minutes to play in this one. But leading Torino by a goal to nil in Turin. Bremer with an OG just before half-time. A Wolves set piece, I think it was a corner, found its way into the net via Bremer. And Wolves 1-0 up. But Adama Traore starting on the right-hand side for Wolves tonight. No Matt Doherty involved. He trained, according to the hacks that are over there with Wolves yesterday, did have that kind of tape that guards muscles on his right leg, was taken off during the game against Manchester United during the week. He's a worry in terms of whether or not he can play against Switzerland if he's not playing football.
It is a concern. I should say it was that Jim Allister was the main opponent of the Linfields. And people who've watched political debates in recent times would have encountered Jim Allister. It is no surprise.
Me. Does he talk with a bit of a couple of Wesley?
It is no surprise. But I know Wolves, in fairness, in the Europa League, now this is obviously a more serious tie, they have actually used it to play a second string side as well.
Yeah.
It was a slight concern that Doherty went off the weekend. Although, in a strange way, you sort of know he's not going to play for Ireland at this point. It doesn't have the sense of
oh Christ, he's missing, what
Ireland
are we going to do?
Injury blow. It wouldn't cross my radar. You do all those stories around this time, but when McCarthy was so firm about not playing Coleman and Doherty together again, you're sort of thinking, well, Seamus Coleman has actually started the season well, he's playing, he's first choice, he's fit.
But if he's not fit, then that becomes the worry.
Of course, yeah. But that you're into sort of whataboutery territory to a degree.
I'm happy to delve there, Dan.
But Seamus Coleman got struck down, and all of a sudden, this Wolves chat is pivotal.
Mm. But it plays into something you mentioned in your piece earlier on today, and I guess we can get to a little bit later on as well. Whereas minutes for Republic of Ireland players, especially heading in to this game at the Aviva on September 4th, is a major concern because the players just not getting games.
Yeah, no, I did a piece on that today, just looking at some of the Premier League players in particular. I mean, it's this day, fortnight, this time 2 weeks from now, Ireland will be in the Aviva playing Switzerland in a game that could determine whether we have a tournament here next summer that Ireland participate in or not. It's a pretty big game. And when you have a situation where Jeff Hendrick, Robbie Brady, Glenn Whelan at this stage, although he's played reserve football, but he hasn't played a first team game yet, at least he will. Shane Long, they've played no minutes this year. And someone like Hendrick in particular, as much as McCarthy said with the weekend, well, he's a fit lad and he'd be confident enough. We've seen how Ireland play. Against Georgia, Hendrick and Harahan were sort of setting the tone a bit. And Hendrick has played regularly enough throughout his club career. And for Hendrick to be in a situation where he hasn't played any club football at all, and that's his first game of the season.
And even last
bit of a concern.
Saturday, seeing it was a Douglas Luiz preferred in midfield for Villa, and granted he had a mistake for the first goal they conceded, but then scored an absolute howitzer. That doesn't necessarily do Conor Herrihan's case any good.
No. I mean, at least he started the first game, and maybe Villa they're going to mix and match a small bit, whereas with Hendrick it seems like possibly the fact he's in his last year of his contract. I wonder, is there other issues there? Because he's not been replaced by a new signing. It's just players that were there before that he was ahead of. And I think the point is, for Ireland to be really effective, as we've seen, it needs to be high energy, it needs to be high tempo. And if the Georgia game at home, you had Whelan sitting, and it was Hendrick and Harahan that were almost box to box and really set the tone for their performance. So, I know modern Premier League clubs have top-class sports science and top-class pre-season preparations, but McCarthy has gone on and on about minutes as something that's a concern. And if you have a situation where your two midfielders in that engine room haven't played, with a 3-day preparation for the game where you need to be tuned in and don't necessarily need to be wondering how someone is moving, it's definitely a slight concern, I think, that's going to be niggling in the back of his head.
Yeah, it's something we can revisit a little bit later on. Just to reiterate, Kevin Doyle, not that one, although it possibly could be, we don't know, was leading the charge in our goal auction for that pair of All-Ireland football final tickets and a piece of artwork adorned with the signatures and faces, indeed, of several Dublin legends. Kevin had a bid of €950, but it's grand if it's delayed, it's fine. Carolyn Lennon has pushed it up to four figures, or beyond four figures. It now stands at an even €1,000. Keep your bids coming in, 53106 for 30 cents. will announce the successful highest bidder on tomorrow morning's OTBAM.
3-1 Linfield.
Come on now,
this is getting preposterous.
This is actually like a second leg that they can go and protect.
This is like Linfield are a proper part-time club as well. Like, you know, we talk about, you know, status. Linfield are a part-time club. You know, they're a massive club, but they are very much a part-time operation. David Healy, the manager.
Pat Fennin's involved, isn't he?
Pat Fennin is involved. But, you know, a lot of their players will be part-time. David Healy, like, central to so many great Northern Irish football nights. But if he could mastermind it as a manager...
Well, he goes again. He's one of these players that goes against your theory. That, you know, you need minutes to go and prosper in international football. But he cast your mind back to what he was doing on that run for Northern Ireland.
He was a professional Northern Ireland international.
That's pretty much it.
Like, it was his job.
Was it Sunderland? And he was at Preston, I think, for a bit as well.
Was it Fulham for a while? Fulham, maybe?
Yeah. But getting games? Not really.
No. He was just constantly on a programme working towards the next international win.
Ah, listen, it worked for him, and he's clearly found a way to do the exact same thing with this Linfield side as well. Cast your mind back to 1992, the very birth of this game we call association football. The birth.
There was no football before then.
It didn't happen.
That montage on Sky at the start of the season was the first ever football montage ever.
You are absolutely correct. Anybody who mentions the word St. and Greavesy to you or an English football championship are lying. Didn't happen at all. Joshua Robinson is a Wall Street Journal European sports reporter and co-author of The Club, How the Premier League Became the Richest, Most Disruptive Business in Sport. I'm delighted to say that Joshua joins us on the show this evening. Good evening, Joshua.
How you doing, guys?
It's a weird thing that I happen to have watched a lot about, because there's we mentioned St. and Greavesy there in jest almost in leading into talking to you here, Joshua. And at the time, there was a lot of talk on their show because that was the one magazine show that covered football. It was essentially the football focus of the day when ITV had coverage to the first division in England. There's a lot of coverage at the time of these talks that were going on behind closed doors of a certain cabal of disgruntled chairman who wanted a better share of money from, particularly from TV. They'd seen the opportunities that Italian 90 had created for football, and they wanted to reap those benefits. It seems unimaginable that the Premier League didn't exist, and that the Premier League and its financial model didn't exist before then. But they really wanted a fairer shake in how they were being treated by the higher-ups in football.
Well, you have to remember really how dire the financial situation was in those days. The idea, the very idea of making money from a football club was insanity. And people sort of treated these things like almost like, you know, crumbling chateaus in France, things to be kind of looked after and maintained, but not anything that was really for profit and that didn't exist for anyone beyond the immediate community. When we talk about people like David Dean and really the big five in those days, so that was Liverpool, Everton, Arsenal, Spurs, and Man United, there were a group of young owners there who realized and had this brainwave that actually this was not just sport, this was entertainment, and you could make money from it, and you could make a different experience, not just for the fans who are in the stadium, but also turn it into a TV product. And a big part of that wasn't just Italian 90, as you mentioned, but also guys like David Dean were spending time in the States, and they'd seen a little local business called the NFL. And that was what really turned them on to the possibilities of, hang on, we don't just have football here. We have a proper show on our hands.
Was it just the TV money and the disparity in what they eventually could claim from Sky, as it turned out to be, and we'll get to that in a moment, as opposed to what they were getting from ITV or before that again the BBC? Was it just purely a TV deal, or was it a case where, because it strikes me, I remember watching an interview and a piece about Liverpool around about the time that Kenny Dalglish left the club in 91, and they'd been in a situation where they were ultimately forced to let John Aldridge go because they couldn't afford his wages. He went off to Real Sociedad because they just a year prior brought back Ian Rush, and we're talking about the most successful club at the time in England, and they had to be careful about balancing their books, and they weren't playing in front of an empty Anfield week in and week out. There was, you know, 40 odd thousand people in there. It strikes me that they were just oddly run businesses, that they didn't realise essentially what they had on their hands at the time.
No, I mean, and football had this problem basically promoting from football, you know, and they were run as hobbies, where if you did well in your local community, you bought the local football club and you ran that kind of as a side concern. And, you know, it was a trophy that you held on to and maybe passed on to your kids. But the only real revenue stream for most of these clubs was ticket sales. because the way the TV deal was done in those days was that all 92 professional clubs earned exactly the same share from what the BBC or ITV was paying, which was madness to the people at the Big Five. They thought, people aren't tuning in to watch, you know, Club 91 or Club 92. They're watching Man United and they're watching Arsenal and Liverpool. That's what they want to see. And so that was kind of the driving philosophy that made them think, we're not getting our due here.
Just bring people up to date. Sorry, Joshua, break in there. It's now Torino 1, Wolves 2 over in Italy. Fantastic work down the right by our man Traore to set up Diogo Jota to put Wolves 2-0 up on the night. But Di Silvestri has just pulled one back for the host, Lorenzo Di Silvestri, for Torino. And as we mentioned, it is still Linfield 3 with 7 minutes to go, Carabag 1, Celtic 2-0 up at home to AIK. And Rangers earlier on away to Legia Warsaw drew 0-0. We mentioned that was an increase in what the potential commercially clubs could do was slowly being realised by the likes of David Dean, by the likes of Irving Scholar at Tottenham and others. But there was some resistance, as you mentioned. Like there had been this thing of, well, each of the 92 clubs gets a say, and each of the 92 clubs gets an equal amount, and each of the 92 clubs has to be treated with the same amount of respect. But this cabal of clubs said, no, well, we're the ones drawing the water here. We're the ones that are the product. We're the ones that can actually go and earn a decent bit more money than we're being allowed at the moment.
Exactly. And it was that realization that made them understand how archaic the system of English football was. And it was then quite a big decision to say, listen, we're going to go and we're going to try to dismantle basically 100 years of the way things have always been done. But no one had kind of taken a critical view that way and thought, well, this is not the most efficient way to do things. This is not the most profitable way to do things. And it was why they had to have those meetings in secret, because there was so much pushback that, you know, they could have been frozen out of future talks if they had tried to effectively raise this mutiny against the structure of English football and failed.
Were there any of the top flight sides at the time opposed to this potential breakaway?
None of the ones who realized that they really stood to profit. That much was, you know, they understood cold hard cash when push comes to shove. And so they gained a groundswell of support quite quickly because they were very clever in the way they decided to form the breakaway. It happened in stages. First, they kind of broke up the BBC ITV cartel, as they called it, because they thought, hang on, they're keeping prices artificially low between themselves, and we're the ones getting cheated out of money here. So they did that, and then really when the time came, they found a loophole that allowed them to break free of the structure of the FA, form the Premier League, and then they were free to negotiate with whoever they wanted. And the timing was incredibly lucky there, because Rupert Murdoch had a failing cable business, a failing satellite business in Britain at that time, and was prepared to gamble on football.
Yeah, they basically Sky had kind of swallowed up British Sky Broadcasting, because they themselves had kind of, I guess, died a death with their own squareal type of business. And,
exactly.
And Sky themselves were still very much finding their feet, and they really found something that they could anchor their product on, mm-hmm. and they could drive subscriptions. That was something that wasn't there before, and basically be a massive revenue generator for them. But the way that Sky came to the table and the way that Sky happened to have the biggest bids was a unique one, because Alan Sugar, who was involved in Tottenham, had a major role to play in that, I believe.
Yeah, he was pushing for, in fact, the Big Five had kind of between them endorsed ITV's bid and figured that'll be the one for us. But Alan Sugar had a vested interest in pushing Sky, because he was the man selling satellite dishes, because he ran a company called Amstrad. And that was the supplier to Sky for satellite dishes. And he sort of blew up the whole plan, or the best laid plans of the Big Five driving the Premier League breakaway. And ultimately did enough and pushed, got Sky committed enough that they kind of outstripped him and realized, yes, this is a great idea, and we're going to put enough money on the table to make this happen. And it was on the morning of the auction that Sky produced an extra 30 million pounds out of nowhere to beat ITV to the punch.
Was that money that they actually had, or was it money that they figured they stood to recoup should they actually get this over the line?
it was a bit of both, to be honest. But Murdoch was convinced that sports could be successful because he'd already invested heavily in Australia and was buying up the rights to the things like the NFL in the US.
Yeah, Fox Sports at the time had become a major player, I guess, at the table over in the US.
Like, I mean, Joshua, is there a sense that the people, I mean, you introduced it there, that they knew there was latent potential there that hadn't been tapped into, but you look at the monster that it's become now and even the value of the TV rights now. I mean, is there a sense that they couldn't believe how quickly it took off from that point?
I mean, you're talking to people who, when Greg Dyke did the first ITV deal and offered them £1 million a season, they nearly fell off their chairs. That much blew them away. They could never conceive of the kind of money that would come later. And none of them really stuck around long enough to see what it has become now. I think the last of that bunch was really Martin Edwards and David Dean, who left in the mid-2000s.
It is bizarre to see, because we talk about the... we talk about the first division as well as the Premier League as it is then, living or dying by potentially having this extra few million quid that was incoming from UK TV and UK TV alone. Whereas now it seems that UK TV, although the money being paid to them is massive and is vast, the overseas element of it has just become more crucial, I guess. And you only have to look at the sponsors that are on, I think, 10 of the 20 jerseys in the Premier League this year. Like, the overseas market in Asia in particular, in terms of what the revenues that they're bringing in, it just supersedes anything the UK can.
And you talk about not imagining the possibilities. In 1992, in that first deal, the league was paying foreign broadcasters to carry the games, not the other way around. And they thought it would be such an insignificant little piece of their income that when they drew up the original formula for revenue sharing, which is the one that governed the Premier League until for 25 of its seasons, they said, "Oh, you know what? We'll just do an equal share of the foreign rights money for everyone because it's not going to be anything anyway." Only in the past couple years did the Big Six realize, "Hang on. This is exactly what was happening before 1992. We're the clubs that people are tuning in to watch from China, from Africa, from the United States. Why should we have to settle for an equal share with Huddersfield?"
Is that the new club now? I mean, is the top six the new club now, in the sense that those, like, you know, the vision that those chairmen had at that time? I mean, where does it go? Because once the top six get a bigger cut of the TV rights, that surely changes the dynamic possibly forever.
Absolutely. And you've got these six really driving the conversation in that room. And now we're at a time where there is no permanent Premier League chief executive as well. So they have an unprecedented amount of power. And a couple of years ago, they did something very significant, which was push for a small but important change in the way the foreign revenue is distributed, so that the top, I believe, eight clubs got a slightly larger share and it was scaled down towards the bottom of the league. And that changed the ratio that we hear so much about. You know, the Premier League always threw around this ratio of the winner gets 1.6 times what the bottom club gets. And that's very close compared to, say, the Bundesliga or La Liga, where you're looking at ratios of 3 and 4 times, which was growing the inequality in the league. That in the Premier League today, it's no longer 1.6, but 1.8. And it's that first step. It's as we say in the book, taking a chisel to the Ten Commandments, the idea that you can change that founder members agreement that they all signed in 1992. And then if you've changed it once, then there's no limit to how many more times you can come back and say, "Well, this is no longer relevant to us."
I've been hearing talk of a European Super League pretty much since the inception of the Premier League itself back in 1992. But it strikes me from listening here, when you think of the Big Six as they are now and their ability as rainmakers to draw revenues from around the world for the Premier League, they are going to at some stage look beyond the moorings of England. And I remember at the time being spoken of the Sky deal, who's going to want to watch two Premier League matches a week on TV? Well, it turns out the appetite is slightly more than that, and the people will happily watch TV like matches every night of the week once they're on. That old Declan Lynch saying, if there's a football match on TV, it behooves you to watch it. Like, there is going to be a point where they actually go, "Do you know what? We're kind of being held down by England a little bit here," and there are other clubs around Europe are going to do the exact same, and they see the revenues that are on offer to them, particularly when we have these preseason tournaments in Asia and in America that draw in massive numbers and are their own standalone events, and they'll go, well, listen, where there's money to be made, we're just going to have to go there.
Well, I think the bigger Premier League clubs are intrigued, but it's really the other huge European clubs that have been influenced by the Premier League themselves and look at the Premier League and think, how do we get a bit of that? Because their TV rights are dwarfed by the Premier League's, and they would love to be playing Premier League clubs every weekend and tapping into those audiences and drawing some of that money as well for themselves. Because, you know, Juve and Bayern and, you know, the two Spanish super clubs, Real and Barca, their domestic leagues do not have the same kind of global attention that the Premier League commands. The Premier League is in 185 countries every weekend. And it has a large lead in the market that all of them are obsessed with, which is the United States, you know, because that is the biggest media market in the world. In terms of people who will pay for subscriptions, who will then use their disposable income to buy merchandise, even travel to England and go to games. You know, there's a huge audience there that's just waiting. And it's seen as almost a gold rush for all the major European clubs. And if the Super League gets them there, then they're prepared to do it.
Joshua, I feel you may have another book in the offing within the next 4 or 5 years, or potentially even less, the way things are going. Thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Joshua Robinson there, co-author of The Club, How the English Premier League Became the Wildest, Richest, Most Disruptive Force in Sports, and a great read. It is too. A third for Wolves in Italy, Dan.
Yeah, Raul Jimenez. It's really opened up this game. There's been chances really at either end, and particularly Wolves, they threaten every time they go forward nearly. And yeah, Jimenez, the Torino defence, parted. And he strolled through, good finished.
Yeah, Torino haven't been defending brilliantly all night, it must be said. And there has been a late goal as well in injury time, and a penalty too for Carabag from Magi Gay. The forward has pulled the penalty.
Ex-Everton, I think he is. I think he was at Everton for a time.
At one stage, I think he might be right there.
Four or five years ago, yeah.
Magi Gay pulling that penalty back 2 minutes into added time at Windsor Park, but it has finished Linfield 3, Carabag 2. Linfield will have something to protect in Azerbaijan next week, rather incredibly. Celtic as well in action tonight. They have entered stoppage time in that game. They're leading AIK of Sweden by 2-0. James Forrest has been prolific in Europe so far this season, getting the first of those 3 minutes after the break. And 17 minutes from time, Odson Edward doubled their lead. Scoreless draw for Rangers tonight away to Legia Warsaw. Loads more to come on the football show as well. We'll be looking at how the spending power of the big European clubs we just mentioned there has grown exponentially over the past while, and all due to the influence of one George Soros, would you believe? Incredible stuff. Our football coverage is brought to you thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunleavy.net.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag SaveOurShirt.
And you're very welcome back to Thursday night's football show. It being Thursday night, we are festooned with Europa League action tonight. That latest score with 14 minutes to go over in Turin is Torino 1, Wolves 3. Patrick Cotone has just come on for Wolves, making his second substitute appearance for the club. Linfield with a rather remarkable 3-2 win at home to Karabag. They'll head to Azerbaijan with something to protect next week, but Karabag will be fancying their chances with those two away goals in the bag. Celtic 2-0 up at home to AIK of Stockholm, and Rangers earlier on drawing 0-0 away to Legia Warsaw. Celtic, we should mention as well, in the middle of that game with AIK Parkhead, announcing the re-signing, I guess you call it, of Fraser Forster. He's back at Celtic after a spell at Southampton, which has turned, I want to say sour, but it's definitely gone quiet for him at the South Coast Club in the Premier League over the past year or two. So Fraser Forster joining Celtic on a season-long loan on a night when Craig Gordon keeps a clean sheet. It's a ringing endorsement to know there's a backup keeper coming.
Yeah, it's always perfect timing, isn't it, when something like that happens? But yeah, I suppose Celtic, if you sort of forget their window is still open, they've still got time to do stuff. And for them, that's a big one tonight, because AIK aren't the worst, you know, the Swedish champions. And as much as, you know, they have bigger fish to fry, and maybe in terms of once they're not in the Champions League, 10 in a row is probably the priority, maybe above a Europa League run. But still, Rangers look like they have a very good chance of being in the Europa League. And you know, still 4 million quid or whatever. And yeah, they, I mean, the Celtic, there's obviously still a lot of unhappiness there over the fact they went out of the Champions League as they did and they need to spend more money. And I don't know if bringing Fraser Forster back is one that's really, is that, is that what they were looking for?
Sports.
No.
Their main issue there has been, I guess, selling players below what the fans perceive would be the market value of those players. But it's something we mentioned, I think, on the show. I think you were in with us a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this during the news round. It's that, like, other clubs, especially from outside of the Scottish Premiership, view the Scottish Premiership as a lesser league.
Oh,
so
yeah.
they like the performances that are contained within have that asterisk beside them of being, yeah, well, it was in the Scottish Premiership.
Mm.
It's not exactly, he's done it for 2 years in the Premier League, he's done it in Serie A, he's done it in La Liga. It's like Virgil van Dijk moved to Southampton for the money he did because he did pretty well at Celtic. But again, albeit with Champions League football, he was in.
When you look at the fees, I suppose, that some of the players that Celtic moved for. Now, it's just life. It's like, it's all at a smaller scale. You know, Seamus Coleman goes for 60 grand. You know what I mean? Like, there's all these things you look at years later. But I mean, Celtic, obviously, you know, you mentioned van Dijk as well, but even the likes of Wanyama. Okay, I know he's not necessarily a Spurs player, but he's still a bloody good player, you know, and there's been a lot of other decent players. Even someone like Timo Pukki now, who like he had his, okay, it's a long time since he was at Celtic. He spent 4 years at Bromby afterwards, but he couldn't necessarily cut it when he was there at that time as well, you know. And like it's like their recent sort of record of identifying talent has actually been pretty decent. I don't think that's the problem that people at the club, well, I don't know, I don't think that's the problem that fans of the club have. It's more what they've done, I think, with some of the money sometimes as well. You know, and what these players went on to be worth. How have they spent some of the funds that they've accrued from these players?
Hans Nedward looks like a decent purchase that's happened.
Dembele was the other young one as well, I was trying to think of. Sorry, yeah. They got for a song. Like, the people at the club actually did some, they have done some good business in terms of actually identifying players and selling them on at a profit, albeit not the value that they were ultimately worth in the long run. But it's still, you know, the level of investment that Celtic have really taken a punt to be ambitious and be brave. Because I think the problem that some of their fans have this summer as well is that they've signed some players who haven't even been used in the European games. They did do some shopping this summer, but they clearly weren't up to it.
Yeah.
And haven't been able to play them in these matches. So, anyway, it's clearly a frustrating time. Any Celtic fans are sort of follow on social media and stuff, there seems to be a sense of anger there across the summer that I'm not sure it's going to go away from that game tonight and getting into the Europa League. But
it strikes me as once Celtic fans get in their head that regime change is required, and this is something that goes back to the 90s when the club was being like terribly run at board level, once they get into the idea that they need to change and it might be warranted, something is going to happen. There is a hand going to be forced at some stage. With them, we've had a text in which says, really enjoying the show, thank you for that, Christine Ennis. It was actually at Bowes versus Linfield back in the 80s, 84 I think, wasn't it?
Bowes Rangers was 84, no?
Bowes Linfield was at some stage as well, anyway. Yeah. It says, could they get Celtic if they get through, from Christine Ennis?
They absolutely could, yeah, there'd be no reason why they wouldn't. Linfield, if they got through, would be in as bottom seeds.
Yeah.
So I was trying to recall, Celtic would be very highly rated, so yeah, they could get Rangers as well. They could have Rangers in, like, well, obviously Celtic couldn't get Rangers though.
That'd
be the dream. But Linfield Rangers would be like, I don't know,
it's a certain type of fan would be very happy with that draw.
It'd be like a double bill. It'd be like, I don't know, I'm trying to think, it's not Bob Dylan and Neil Young, is it? But like, it would bring a lot of similar enthusiasts along to the gig, you know.
In terms of influence, I want to say it'd be like the Beatles and maybe Oasis on the same bill, if you can manage that.
Yeah,
I think you'd probably figure out who'd be who in that one, but there you go. Linfield and Celtic, or indeed Linfield
it's
and Rangers,
possible,
is,
yeah,
is very much, although such is the vast expanse of the group stage of the Europa League, the bloody well anything is possible.
Yeah, they could also bring Zorya Lubyansk or whoever it might be. I think Linfield have a job to do now. After, I think a 3-1, you'd think they could, good sort of organised team could see it out. 3-2, probably a bridge too far, but imagine the buzz they're going to have for the next week now.
Stretching
it. Just thinking about it.
A little bit. I want to talk about things closer to home, because I know you've written about this as well today. Neil Fenn looks like he's going to be the next manager of Cork City.
Yeah, looks like it. He's left Longford, who didn't see it coming at all. And I think they possibly might have known that Neil Fenn was going to be an option for Cork at the start of next season, rather
it's
than
an odd point of the season for this to be happening.
Rather than three games from the end of this season. It's probably going to leave a bit of a sour taste, but I mean, this is life. He's got a chance to go from a part-time first division club to a club he used to play for, and it will be a full-time job, you know, and you have to look after number one. He probably in time, if it all goes the way it looks like it's going to go, it's going to leave a sour taste, and maybe in time you might wish it would have been handled better, but I don't know. It's football, like, you know, people throw you out the door 1 minute pretty quickly as well. You know, I know Longford have supported them and given them a reasonable budget and stuff like that, but people will look after number one to a degree. I mean, if he wasn't getting results, they might kick you out the door any minute as well. So that's always you have to sometimes move when your currency is high.
But the timing of it strikes
me. It's not great. Like, I mean, Longford are three. Cork, I suppose, from their perspective.
Do they need to get somebody in the door from a club?
Clearly they feel they do. I mean, I thought Cork might leave it a bit longer, but they have a lot of players up. Their contracts, established players, their contracts are up at the end of the year, and maybe they feel that the guy making the decisions on this stuff should be the guy who's going to be the manager next year, rather than him coming in with certain players being let go or they've signed up somewhere else or whatever it might be. So that's the rationale behind it. I can't think of too many recent parallels, even in other leagues, where someone comes in like just right at the end of the season, you know. But if you're going to, I suppose, rebuild over the winter, why just wait for the sake of it, I guess, if you're going to take a very hard-nosed view of it?
Well, it's almost as if they want somebody in. I think it has happened in England, funny enough, whereby somebody will come in and basically be instilled for pre-season so they can oversee everything towards pre-season. I think Fenn, if it does transpire that he does become the next Cork manager, will be overseeing everything that goes on. Yeah. Players that are coming, players that are more often than not then going. But it's a big job he has in his hands there. Want to talk about this article that was in the Times earlier on today as well.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of people might have been scratching their heads wondering about the fees that are going on in European football at the moment. It's something that we touched on with Joshua there just before the break. When we see the likes of, you know, 120 million for Antoine Griezmann, when we see the likes of 100 odd million for João Félix going to Atletico Madrid, and people are kind of going, oh, well, football's just gone mad. That's just the way it is. But there's also you see stories in the lead up to the Griezmann one where they're contacting the banks and they're letting it be known that they're going to activate his release clause. And it turns out that Barcelona had a bit of trouble getting the banks to give them money because they're basically asked them already for loans to redevelop the Camp Nou. So they've had other means of going about trying to get money for, which for me, it seems odds and it seems unsustainable, and it seems like something that for at least one club, I don't mean any of these that are involved at the moment, but somebody's going to get stung by this somewhere down the line through an inability to move players on or to not have things done as the way they want to see it. Like 23 Capital is the name of the company.
Yeah.
It's backed by George Soros, who's responsible for so much in the world.
Yeah, we may as well be involved in the high end of professional football.
Why not?
But it was interesting, I saw the term that Barcelona had effectively took a bridging loan. Like, bridging loan, eh?
Because it's, whoa.
I've got bridging loan in like News Now as a search. I was like, I get all these alerts on bridging loan related articles. Like, oh, wait a minute.
Oh, it's another email from the FAI. Hello.
What does this mean? What's this mean? But it was interesting in the Times piece that there was a quote from like an expert who I think he was interviewed, or someone actually, maybe the CEO of the 23 Capital Group itself.
So they're pretty open to talking about
speaking about how that in England the banks used to lend freely based against the club's property, like, which was a way of doing it, I guess, an old school way of doing it. But then the likes of Coventry, Sheffield Wednesday, a couple of problem clubs, they realised this wasn't the way to go. But I guess at the top end of the scale, when you've got sort of future broadcasting income of such a substantial guaranteed scale over a long period of time, you can start to do some business based on that income's coming their way. There are slight parallels, to be fair, at a different level with events closer to home where you have guaranteed future income and how that affects your borrowing and bank deals over a period of time. I think if you were to go over the recent history of Irish football, you would find a lot of parallels by scale. But the fact that Barcelona are doing it, you know, to get them through a summer of business, I guess it's like the whole concept of third-party ownership and all these layers of football that we don't really know are there. Like, we sort of know that they exist.
Yeah.
It's like you had Joshua on earlier talking about, like, his book. There's probably a great book in, I don't know, like 100 people you've never heard of in football who are really influential in football. Because I would assume that the people running these companies, they're on speed dial, they're on the WhatsApp or, you know, recent calls lists of some of the most influential people in world football. They're essential.
So, like, I read some of the quotes from this guy from 23 Capital. He's not just some guy. He's the CEO. Jason Traub is his name. And it's just stuff like, we work with clubs in the top tier in the big leagues as well as promoted teams. You need to assess how much they can spend without overstretching themselves. We lend above about £2 million for transfer deals and many millions of pounds for bigger projects over periods of time for between 1 and 8 years. The repayments may be set at certain times of the year based on what a club receives money from the sale of a player or from broadcasting income. Like you mentioned there, basically it's offset against what they're going to be earning anyway. But there will come a time when one of these clubs is going to be bitten in the hole by this. Mm. Like at the other end of the scale, like you mentioned, League of Ireland clubs, we look at what's going on at Bury. Like, to a degree, and it happened when ITV Digital went
I was just going to say, and in Scotland as well, with their TV deal, there was issues, the Satanta deal, I think it was.
Like, there was a lot of English league clubs nearly went to the wall, and a couple came very close, if not actually did, at the time of the ITV Digital collapse. Mm. And that basically went, that had ripple effects throughout the entirety of football in England.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody is suddenly unable, for whatever reason, to make one of these repayments to 23 Capital, I mean, they're not a charity.
No. No, of course not. But I guess this is why, at the upper end of the scale, I mean, the Barcelonas of this world, talking about European Super League, they're not going to have a problem. It's always the classic case. It's like, who's going to get into trouble with their mortgage? It's not going to be the people at the top end of the scale. It's the people who've overstretched in the first place or who've operated very close to the threshold. They're the ones that are always going to be more vulnerable. But in this instance, this is what we're talking about. I mean, the amount of money we're talking about here, like, just that people might be aware of the figures, the reporters have given Barcelona a loan of €35 million for 6 months, euro, and a separate loan of €85 million, euro, which had to be paid back during the transfer window when some players were sold, yeah, including Andre Gomes and Denis Suarez and others. But, like, it's massive amounts of money. Because you always hear about transfer deals as well, that you hear like a 70 million fee. It's not always like 70 million paid to the club. It's often in installments as well.
Arsenal are great crack for that.
Like, Leeds are probably still paying for some players they signed from back in
Seth Johnson's.
They're still paying some of their wages, I'd assume, like at this stage, you know? But it is the other layer of football.
Well, the one thing, like you mentioned there, like third party ownership is frowned upon and is, you know, banned in. But like, this enters into a grey area whereby the money is coming from not a bank, but just this random capital fund who are able to give money to clubs when they ask for it, and they'll repay it, and that's fine. But then you see the loan deals at the minute is the one thing, like a loan with an option to buy, which is essentially, there is a third party ownership thing going on there because the other club own it. It's a whole level of grey area, who players belong to whom, and they're basically just book fiddles at the end of the day.
Yeah, and like, particularly when you have something like financial fair play as well, and the questions that financial fair play has raised in recent years, particularly with regard to clubs that are deemed to have breached it, who have used sponsorship money, you know, as a form of turnover to sort of keep them within the rules. And you sort of wonder what the boundaries are with some of these transactions. I mean, naturally, it's known that clubs will always have some form of banking arrangement that will help them through a particular point of view. That will happen at any level of the game. But with the actual amounts that are here, you sort of wonder how they show up in the books relative to their overall accounts in a given year.
Murky,
It's a murky business. But hey, listen, Jason Traub, the CEO of 23 Capital, is happy to openly speak about the services he offers. So maybe it's all perfectly grand.
A decent man, I'd imagine, to ask for a pint as well at the bar, because he probably has a few quid in his own back burner. A hell of a game at the Olympic Stadium over there in Turin, where Torino have pulled another one back, and Andrea Belotti penalty in the final minute of normal time. He's just forced a great save as well at Rui Patricio on the Wolves goal, and they've just forced another corner as well. Have Torino 3-2 Wolves lead in Northern Italy at the moment. A 2-0 victory for Celtic at home to AIK tonight, and that 3-2 win for Linfield at home to Carabag. Just to bring you up to date on our auction tonight, we have a new highest bidder. Well done to Paul McCormick, no relation as far as I'm aware, who has stumped up €1,100 for these All-Ireland football final tickets, Dublin versus Kerry, and that specially commissioned artwork by Paul Baker, which features some Dublin footballing icons, and all in support of Goal. We'll be announcing our victorious highest bidder on tomorrow morning's OTB AM from 7:30. More to come after these.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag Save Our Shirt.
into the final 20 seconds of added time in Turin. Torino 2, Wolves 3 in the Europa League playoff round first leg. The bids keep rolling in. And the Lark Inn in Mead Street, fine establishment, I'm told, have come in with €1,150 for these All-Ireland football final tickets and that artwork as well. And it's all with thanks to Goal. €1,150. If you think you can do better, text Goal along with where you are and your bid to 53106 with thanks to 30 cents. And congratulations as well to Cullum Finn, who correctly identified tonight's mystery voice.
I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
It was, of course, Richie Hogan. Congratulations, Cullum. You've won a pair of tickets to our Premier League roadshow at the Borgosh Energy Theatre on September 4th. We'll give you more chances to win over the next few days. Tomorrow morning, OTBAM is back at 7:30 on all of our social channels. It's our live daily sports breakfast show. Tomorrow night, we've got Olympic gold winning medal triathlete Alistair Brownlee in studio, and Friday night racing as well. Final whistle's gone down in Turin. Some glum faces on those of the Torino players, but I think they'll have enough to think that they can go to the Midlands in a week's time and take something from their 3-2 victory for Wolves tonight. They're happy campers. Tom Dunshow is up next with...
That ubiquitous...
He's not in, is he? JP shaking his head. No, it's me. I'm sorry.
Surely you should have a medley to bring you all the way through. Some kind of tune just to bring you all the way through.
Like some Stars and 45 clapping disco number.
Yeah. While you change studios.
I will consider making some Jive Bunny Mega Mix for the duration of the 2 hours that we have coming up in the Tom Dunn Show. But Paul is going to be sick of the side of me inside as well. But thank you for your contributions as well tonight, Daniel.
Cheers, Richie.
Read more of Dan in the Irish Independent as well. But yeah, I'm up next after these. Thank you so much, guys.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag Save Our Shirt.